Hello, interdimensional beings of light and diamond beauties. It's Lisa here, your mystic guide, inviting you to come and take a ride with me as we journey through space and time. We'll be conversing about the occult and the mystical, Ayurveda and natural healing, and the divine feminine. Welcome to the Buddhist Biohacker.
The Buddhist Biohacker podcast is affiliated with Purity Coffee and Dry Farm Wines. Purity Coffee, organic coffee crafted for health. Drinking healthier coffee is one of the easiest things you can do to improve your wellness, performance, and longevity. Use code ENLIGHTENMENTPIE to save 10% off your first order. Dry Farm Wines, the only health-focused natural wine club in the world. All natural and additive-free. Lab-tested for purity, sugar-free, and lower alcohol. The philosophy of the world's finest pure artisan wines, handcrafted with honesty. Visit www.dryfarmwines.com/Buddhist Biohacker to claim your penny bottle.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Buddhist Biohacker podcast. It's Podcast Wednesday, so this is our third podcast of the day, which has been just a fabulous day. We have been all around, from drumming for your nervous system to fascia decompression, and now we are going to talk yoga this afternoon. I'm your host, Lisa Gunshore. For everybody who's joining in the live, I see you joining in. Welcome in. Come on in with us. You can chat live. You can ask questions. You can share comments and stories. We'd love to hear from you, so please do that. And for everybody who's listening later on the replay on iTunes and Spotify, you can absolutely go to our MeWe forum, that's MEWE.com, Buddhist Biohacker, and we will continue the conversation there. Buddhist Biohacker is creating conscious content for 1111D as we shift to the new reality. Okay, so with all of that out of the way, I am so honored and happy to have Satyam with us today. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. And for those of you who don't know, Satyam was in our May One Heart, One Earth Summit, and just an amazing class and an amazing person. And we're going to start out. I just want you to share a little bit about who you are and what you do for everybody who's listening.
Sure. My name is Satyam, and I am an aspirant. I'm a yoga instructor. I am in Sanskrit, the word is sadhak, spiritual aspirant. And these days I teach locally. Locally these days is broadcasting live right from the house. And so, I'm the founder of Renaissance Yoga, and now I'm 53 years old, and I first ventured onto the path when I was 24, 25, where I was looking for, those days, it was the late 80s, early 90s, and I was looking for how was I going to live on this earth? That was my main question. How should I exist while I'm on this earth? You know, a lot of people are jumping into Wall Street. A lot of people jump into law school. And those are veritable paths. But I was intent on finding how should I live on this earth? And that brought me onto the path of yoga.
Yeah. So amazing. And what... I'm curious about the name Renaissance Yoga, actually. Like, where did that come from? What inspired that?
Oh, well, I was just thinking of a name that would be universal in nature, that was not my own name, that I wanted to give something that people might connect with. And Renaissance, I was also a French student in college, and Renaissance means a rebirth, renewal, recharging, and so... I felt that was a very key theme of yoga. And within the yogic traditions, it's a word that's been used with in yogic ideals. So I thought, okay, that'll be a good one.
Yeah, it's so good. I love it because it's different and the energy of it is very accessible, which I think is so wonderful. So what, I know our topic today is why yoga works, but before we really dig into the juicy parts of that, what is your yoga journey? What led you to yoga?
Sure. As I say that I, in those early, in my early 20s, I was looking for a way to live. And it began with a connection with nature, and I started teaching outdoors, working with the Park Service, and looking for what I felt was a holistic way to exist on this planet. And I knew that my older brother had gotten quite involved in yogic meditation. And so that was always sitting in my pocket, waiting for when I said I had full faith that he had found a good path, but I was waiting for when I was kind of ready for it, you know? And so after I had, I was ranger at Mount Rainier National Park one summer, and that was in 1991. And then I told him, I said, hey, when I'm done, I'm coming down to your place. And that was the fall of 1991. He was in Northern California. And within a week or so, an Indian monk, they used to come and stay at our house, one came, and I was taught meditation, and it went into pretty much high gear from there. Little by little, prior life habits and things were shifted into a new way. I was very much looking forward to a new way of living. I had recently become a vegan about 4 or 5 months earlier, and just everything in life I was willing to reconsider, take on, and yoga had all of that. That was the beauty of it. So I didn't have to invent anything. Everything was there. You just had to follow it. You know, for me, there was a deep attraction to do that. So it was effortless. There's always struggle in life, but it was very much effortless. And so each month, each year was a full incorporation of yogic ideals into the lifestyle. And I was, for about 3-4 years, I was straddling living and working in the outdoors and living a kind of yogic life. I was up in Alaska working for the parks. I was teaching Outward Bound at the Canadian border. And then after a while, I was like, I needed to go full into a yogic lifestyle, which I felt at that point I was ready just to do that completely. And that's kind of how my whole life processes have grown, and it led to several trips to India for several months to live with Yogacharya there, and it was all meditation based, and then how that manifests in every aspect of your life, your eating, your sleeping, your breathing, your thinking, your relations, and that's really what I wanted to do. So that was it wasn't swimming upstream for me. It was the outgoing tide. It was just very relaxed and very enjoyable.
Oh, I love that. When you say the yogic lifestyle, for some of these new folks who are joining in who may not know what that means, if you were to define the yogi lifestyle, what would your definition be?
Yeah, a way of living that revolutionizes your existence physically, mentally, spiritually, and where everything is ideally consistent, as far as we're all imperfect beings, but we're moving together, we're trying to improve, and to embrace a spiritual ideal of life, that I'm a unit being, part of a greater cosmic entity, and everything around us is the projection of that same universal entity. We're all related, we're all connected, and trying to realize and manifest that. And meditation is the backbone. And then all our daily living patterns should be a consonant representation of that ideal. And the yogis have become extremely detailed in you know, how to bathe, how to this, how, you know, everything is lined up, you know. So there's no shortage of of practices to incorporate, the food system, the fasting system, and all this is to be done regularly. You know, there's no time. The other thing I liked about, there's no timeouts. Everything counts. You can't say, okay, well, now I'm off. No, there's no off. It's always on. And I found it to be extremely invigorating and very positive, and it very made everything meaningful. And before I was wondering, what are we doing here? What's going to be? But this solved all the issues. It made everything very clean and self-propelling.
You make it sound so easy. Yeah. I think of it, you know, I live an Ayurvedic lifestyle. And so when you talk about those rigorous practices, you know, the tongue scraping and the dry brushing and the oiling, and and I just can't live without that routine also. I'm very disciplined, and I love it. It's not only is it great for my health, but I love how you're describing it, because it is invigorating. It's invigorating. It's like you're empowered to take over your own life and create a healthy life. It's like an empowerment, don't you think?
Absolutely. And the yogis say that at the beginning, when you learn a new practice, you work to make it your habit, you know, and then after a while, when it becomes ingrained with you, it becomes your nature. You become the living embodiment of that ideal. And there's nothing egotistical about it. It's just because that if people watch you and see the way you live, then there's no difference between that and what your ideal is, you know, and that's how people learn. You know, it's very difficult to teach people out of books, but if you are that, or you're emulating, or you're striving to be that, then it's very good. And so the word murti in Sanskrit means embodiment, the embodiment of, and that's all. And anyone who's committed to something, and people will recognize that, you know, whether you're an athlete or whether you're a teacher, and those are the people in those fields of disciplines, the ones who are not doing it from an external perspective, but from the inner core of their being, you know. And you can tell when you go talk to, whether it be a doctor, a healthcare practitioner, or a kindergarten teacher, anyone, you can see they really are that. And those are the best ones. You know, they are a shining light in that ideal, whether it be a plumber. So it's, you know, it doesn't matter. But the yogic ideal is that it's all consuming. And that was very, very attractive for me. And we become habituated, not just habituated, but the mind becomes so linked with that you know, other people may say, isn't that difficult, don't you get tired of that? But it's very energizing, and you don't think about doing anything else. You know, you think, okay, this is good, this is working.
I love it. You know, there's a theme today, I'm thinking as I'm listening to you, between all three guests today and you being one of those three, is that willingness to say yes to where life just took you, you know, where spirit took you, and just diving into it full on and letting it take you everywhere and not holding back and not questioning it, just going for it. And I think that that's so inspiring.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important part, that, that, you know, we should look carefully, but then when the path presents itself, it's important to embrace it. You know, if you keep it at arm's distance, you don't get very far on the journey, you know, and that's with everything, you know, so. Yeah.
So true. Well, so our topic today is why yoga works. So yeah. Why does yoga work? Because, you know, and I know you know this, and there are many people watching and listening to the replay that have said, I can't do yoga, I'm not flexible. I am certain in the state of Colorado and in much of the US, that is definitely something that folks say. Right. And without understanding, it's so much bigger than that. Right. And it's not really about the handstand. It's so much more. And so why does yoga work? What is the bridge to yoga if you're new and you're not sure that it's something you can even do?
Right. Yeah. And let's first address that misnomer or misconception or misunderstanding that flexibility has nothing to do with yoga. That what they say the only thing that's needed to do yoga is that if you've got a human body, it, that's the only prerequisite, really.
And I love that.
So if you've got a human body, then that's enough. That's enough. And then from there, we go, we just do it. It's not a physical endeavor. It's really a spiritual endeavor that has manifestation in the psychic and physical fields. The physical body is by definition limited. No matter how much we try to flap our wings, our arms, we're never going to fly. We can't push our dwellings, our houses. You know, we're very limited physically. There's very little. There's not a lot we can do physically. So the yogic ideal is you're living in this body. This body's your home. We all live in a house, hopefully. We all have a house to live in. But then the body is our clothes. You know, sometimes we're in a car. We're using the car. That's our shelter. But ultimately, the body is our vehicle. And the main use of the body is to maintain it in a very healthy, vibrant, dynamic way. So we feel comfortable. And it's really a house to move the mind around. Because if the mind isn't operating, then we can't do anything. The person may be completely, completely very strong, but if they pass out due to psychic tension or something, then the body becomes limp. It has no energy. And the way we can interact with people is through what ideas we conceive of. And then the body is there to help to facilitate that or to present that with our mouth, our organs, so the body is the vehicle for us, and we need to maintain it. So the yogis are like, okay, well, be careful with your diet, be careful with, and these movements that we do, these asanas, are just one section of what classical yoga is all about, right? If you think of Ashtanga yoga, which the eight limbs of classical yoga, the first two deal with the 10 ways of morality and living in the world called jhamma and niyama. The third one is the physical postures known as asanas. The fourth one is pranayama. The fifth one is withdrawal of mind, vairagya, or you can say pratyahara. And then the sixth one is dharana, concentration. The seventh one is dhyan. And the eighth one is samadhi, or the culmination. So you've got all these dynamic practices, and it's very common or natural that in a mass level, people will link up with the third practice known as the asana, the physical postures, which is what people think of as yoga. But those postures were brought in to get the body comfortable, flexible means it should be comfortable, and those postures help calm the mind as well. And then the bigger question about why yoga works, and it's kind of an interesting question because there aren't too many theories. A lot of theories are brought into the world, but they don't all work all the time. Yoga works because it is based on the yogis looked at the world and they saw all the naturally occurring phenomena and they copied it. They built their theory based on already existing phenomena in this universe. For instance, Isaac Newton, he did not invent gravity. All he did was observe that the way the world was working, the way the universe was working, and he said, this theory is functional. And that's why it doesn't get disproven. You're not inventing a theory out of thin air. You're basing your theory on already a universal practical phenomena. And for the antithesis, for instance, would be something like communism. They thought that in their brain that this would be good, but it went against all human psychology. And it turned into one of the most horrific forces of the 20th century, where a lot of people suffered. They thought it was going to be good. They thought the initial thinker in Germany, and the name's not coming to me, anyway, but he had a benevolent idea, but it was an impractical theory. Whereas the yogic ideal, the yogis saw the mountain standing, they saw the way the animals were moving, and they emulated those postures into physical movements. They thought that would be good for the human being to practice those things. And so it's all based on naturally occurring phenomena in this universe.
I love that you're saying this. You know, I just watched, I brought it up this morning too. My husband and I watched this documentary called The Full Mantis, which I highly recommend to everyone, about this drummer. And he wanted to learn praying mantis, the kung fu practice. Mm. And he didn't have an instructor that would teach him because of the secrecy of the practice at the time. And so he said in this documentary, and they show, he has footage of it when he was younger, he went to the store and bought praying mantis and studied them and watched them and moved with them and looked at them. And it was such a profound piece of this documentary. And here you are bringing this exact thing up. Like, there is so much we can learn by observing. And that's where the discernment comes in, I think. That's the discernment right there. And so I love how you're explaining this, because that is so true about how, you know, it builds. And I'm reading Light on Life by Iyengar, and trying to get through it in my crazy schedule. And it, you know, every page is like a golden nugget, you know? Yeah, but the way that he talks about the practices and the eight limbs that you're talking about, you know, the eight limbs of yoga, and how, you know, here we are in our world, especially a lot of people who are watching too, Satyam, in this community are all very spiritual, right? You know, there's a lot of psychics and healers and empaths, and we're all meditating. And I love how Iyengar says that's kind of like the last thing you do. Like, there's all these other things to line up. And I think I'm just connecting a dot with what you're saying about watching the nature of reality. And I think, you know, if you understand that nature of reality, sitting in that in a meditation is a much easier thing, you know, going through those other limbs than trying to jump straight to the end right away.
Oh, no, it's a journey. The yogis say there's no shortcuts, you know, everyone's got, you got to get every, and no one can do it for you also. So we all got to go through those steps. Maybe we may do it a little bit differently than the next person, but the basic idea that that we've got to, that everybody has to go through certain, you know, disciplines, certain practices, certain experiences, so we all may get there slightly differently, but everybody has to walk the path, you know. You can't be carried by someone else, and you can't pull anybody else. You can help inspire, but ultimately, you know, everybody's got a human body and human mind to fulfill that journey themselves, right? So, they say that the yogis, it's the greatest copycat game in the cosmos, that they watched and then they emulated. They watched and emulated. And what's also really interesting is that all the yogic practices, whether it be from diet to breathing techniques to meditation, all those things, they never get disproven by Western medicine. When Western medicine decides to study those things, they say, yes, that's very good, that's healthy. Nothing has ever been disproven. It may not have been studied yet. That's a different matter. Because the yogis were way, I mean, this has been going on for 7,000 years, and they got to the intuitive end first. They didn't go through the scientific method. With their mind, they got to the end point, and then so they based their practices on that great ideal, but they didn't have all the scientific method to prove it. They couldn't say that, hey, if you follow a yogic diet, you're not going to suffer, you're going to have lower blood pressure, you're not going to suffer from coronary heart disease. That was all proven 6,000 years later when the Western diet went off the rails and there were problems all over the place, and say, hey, we have to cure this. And lo and behold, you know, if you follow the yogic diet, you'll have the cure.
Yep, that makes sense. What do you think about, you know, we're in this unprecedented time, and we've all been, you know, kind of held in this container for a few months. And you were mentioning earlier about how going through the practices, you know, you build a habit, you build a behavior in doing that. How do you think, I mean, I think this has supported us in doing that. And my question is, how do you think as a yogi, how has this time supported your practice or even your students' practice? You know, what have you seen change through the last 12 weeks as we're all in this kind of held space where we have to make changes? We can't be in our routine that may or may not be supporting us.
Yeah, no, that I think it's been a fairly dramatic and meaningful shift. I mean, you never want to see people suffer or go through, but at the same time, it's led to a recalibration, right? People had to rethink what's meaningful in my life. What was I running for when I had the opportunity to chase after all the external endeavors that I was doing? What was making my life so busy? But it forced some type of reflection on what direction my life was going and what is really meaningful and what direction should it go? What should I be placing emphasis on? And I think that's meaningful. That's when one is busy 24/7, people think, oh, that's so great. You're busy. But busy doing what? And to what purpose? Is that busy? Are you putting nails in your coffin by that lifestyle? Are you helping people? What is that busyness? And that's important because sometimes people think anyone who's grown up in the U.S. grew up with the imposition of materialism, of chasing after external phenomena and defining success that way. And that may not always be what success is, or it may not be. So this was an imposed way where everyone was forced to recalibrate in some way, to one degree or another. Those people who are more involved in the path, maybe they got a deeper understanding out of it, but everyone was forced to rethink it. And I've noticed with my students, certainly, they've decided that, you know, this is the time I'm going to sit down for meditation. I'll do 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes in the evening, but I'm going to do it. And so it's been good for people to put their practices, their life practices, at the forefront. And I think it was just a way to slow down and, as they say, rethink things in that regard. Yeah,
I agree. And I think, you know, to your point, you have to ask yourself, is it spirit-led busyness, or am I just distracting myself from everything that I want to look at that I'm not looking at? You know, it's like two different things. And we noticed even in our household here, you know, just my husband not commuting to work. I already worked from home, so I was lucky in that way. But just him not commuting to work, suddenly he had time and space to do some of these projects. And as he did his creative projects, he realized that really the commute was just an excuse and then he could have done them anyway. So there was this awareness shift. And I'm hoping a lot of people, I've seen a lot of folks have that same awareness shift of, wow, I really was just putting this off for no real reason. And now that the reasons, the excuses are taken away, it's like, oh, here's why I really wasn't doing this, or here's why I'm going to do it now. So it's been an interesting time for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you think of, you know, I'm trying to think of how I want to ask this question, because it's hard because there's the physical aspect and the spiritual aspect, but I think you could go to both places. But what is your favorite piece of the practice, and what is your favorite bridge to the practice for somebody who wants to find their way to to yoga and to yoga as a lifestyle.
Yeah, very interesting. My favorite piece of the practice, it's a very good question, because they're all kind of linked, but I do enjoy we do a regular fasting, two or four times a month. Meditation is that's the main thrust, and so I'm not sure which. Well, I can't. All of it has become. I guess it all has its time and place. You know, when the body's stiff, then I enjoy a good physical practice to get everything feeling vibrant and free and comfortable. And when the mind wants to be quiet, then I appreciate what one of the things I really appreciate about yoga, it's applicable for every aspect of life and every time of day, that there's no boredom ever, that there's always something to be done. And one of my favorite things is what we call prachar, propagation of the teachings, to share with everybody that there's something for everyone in it. Like if someone comes to yoga and they say, I've got a bad back, come on in, that's fine. You don't have to say, hey, I want to be one with the cosmos. No, that is not a prerequisite. You know, anyone can come for any reason. Or if someone's suffering from constipation, well, let's take a look at what foods you're eating, what things can help to make you feel a little bit more comfortable in that regard. And so that's the beauty. You said, what's the bridge? Yoga is so dynamic and looks at so many different aspects of life and the beauty of it is when you talk to someone to say, the more we practice it, the more we become, if you don't practice it, you have no insight into it. It's ridiculous. You're never going to become an inspiration to anyone or have the insight to help anyone else if you yourself aren't doing that. And then you're not really true to it either, because you're recommending things that you're not doing, and it gets very muddy, right, very quickly. So an open sense of honesty and say, hey, this is what I do, this is what I'm working on, this is what I'm striving for. And as we do those things, we become very intimately familiar with the practices. What are the difficulties? And that's how you become a guide, actually. What are the pitfalls? What works well? And that idea will intuitively come to you when you feel like an appropriate situation to introduce something to someone. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the biggest, as a practitioner, you want to keep the mind free so that when you meet someone, you can see where are they at and what's the best way to help them make that bridge. And because it's not a cookie square recipe. Every human being is different. Every mind is different. And so people may come onto the path, and naturally, the more they come onto the path, the more similar things start to look. But the entryway is really dynamic. And I've lived with people from all over the world in different ashrams and throughout India, and people came from all different walks of life. And so that's really neat. And just by teaching it, by having students come, I was seeing maybe 150, 200 students a week or something like that.
Wow. But
have people come in and you try and see what's going to work for them best. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think the one thing I love about yoga also that you're bringing to mind is there's really a process to it. And if you follow the process, you can do things you never thought you could do, whether it's with your diet or with your physical body. And, you know, for me, I'm 41 years old and did my first handstand last year at 40. And I couldn't believe it in all my life that was something I was even going to do. But when you learn the systematic way to get there that's healthy and safe, you can do those things at any size with it. You know, it doesn't really matter. It matters more that you're in that discipline and in the process of it. And so, you know, I think What I love about yoga is it really isn't a quick fix. It's not meant to be, you know, pushing through a power vinyasa. It's really about being in the moment, being present with yourself, and really feeling into your body, feeling into your spirit, feeling into your heart, you know, to get where you want to go. And then you can achieve all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And meditation, with what the mind can do in meditation, is every what yoga is Bhagavata Dharma, Dharma. And the first want, or the first characteristic of Dharma, is vistar. It is Sanskrit word vistar. It means expansion. And expansion physically, expansion psychically, expansion psycho-spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, and ultimately spiritually as well. That is tremendous expansion. And the worst thing we can do ourselves is constriction, you know, or constrict ourselves or constrict anyone else. The body becomes bound, the mind becomes bound, it's narrow-minded, that doesn't work. So you have to, and all the yogic practices are about opening up, opening everything in 360 degree formation, to breathe with the cosmos, to let go of all inhibitions, to view everything as an expression of the supreme, and then all the parochialisms and perceived differences that we see with these crude eyes becomes washed away as the mind becomes more and more expanded. And so what you say is so true, that this idea of overcoming our limitations, you know, people who were so shy can become extremely dynamic public speakers, just by, because you're constantly revitalizing and recreating and transforming yourself through the yogic process, physically, through cellular regeneration, and within 21 days, all our cells are different in our body, and the cells are governed by our food, by our drink, by our thoughts, by air, by light, and you can recreate physically your whole cellular structure in 21 days. And if you impose or infuse really sentient life practices, it has a very dramatic effect, and that affects the mind. And then with the meditation, it's constantly, mind is invisible. The brain is physical, but the mind isn't. And so mind is shapeless and can be transformed into any, it can embrace anything, but the mind, like the body, will become governed by habit. And so the yogic ideal is to embrace the most universal outlook, and that's why the yogis don't want anything that will impede the mind. No addictions, no, you know, to get off of those physically, because then the mind is free. The cigarette smoker thinks, hey, I'm free to smoke. But they're really not, but they're not free to not smoke. They've got that, and the physical body gets addicted, the psychology, the emotion, and spirit, they're in prison to that cigarette. And the yogic ideal is to make everything free and boundless, and so it's an ongoing process. And unlike the body, which does age, the mind doesn't. So you can talk to a yogi who's like 100 years old, and their mind will be completely sterling, piercing, you know, vibrant, keen, penetrating thought process going on, because their mind has been so trained over all those years that it's fully embraced that, and they're not limited by. So that's how it is, and I very much appreciate you saying it's a process of overcoming our perceived limitations.
I love the way that you put that. That it is, and in this particular time when our molecular structure is changing, you know, the word quantum is huge at this time, and the only way to take a quantum leap or to make a radical shift in awareness is exactly what you're saying. It's to move beyond your limitations, to push past those. And I can tell you that's what yoga's done for me. I mean, in all these years, I was led to yoga for my health. It had nothing to do with fitness. It was to heal my nervous system. And I Googled how do I heal my nervous system? And these yoga postures popped up and I did some yoga, and that was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And since I've, you know, become a yoga teacher and moved on this other path, but I'll tell you what, like, it pushed me past those limitations of those symptoms and completely freed me from them. I mean, they're gone. And yoga was a big part of that. It's such a beautiful practice, and it's why I love it. You know, when I, at my age, and I know I'm not that old, but, you know, being who I am, to push myself up into a handstand was like, holy cow. Like,
yeah.
And the minute you get inverted is like everything changes. And I heard, and I'm sure you know this, and I want to get your take on this because I have a feeling you have more on this than I do. But, you know, when you have that weightless feeling upside down, you know, it mimics death. And, you know, there's the fears that come up, which is why it's hard to do those things. And so, you know, being inverted in a headstand or handstand, or quite frankly, even in a forward bend, you can still get some of that experience. And I'm just curious, you know, what's your take on, when we talk about inversions, it's all sort of physical, but in that spiritual realm, you know, what's your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, no, those inversions are, it's true, they're important physically, but all the yoga postures affect our glandular system, and our glands affect the mind. And that yoga is the only physical exercise that is based on the glands, not based on the muscles. And so it has a tremendous, that you're exercising the glands. Everything in this universe needs exercise. And so you're revitalizing yourself physically, but also psychically and spiritually, because the glands hover right around the main chakras, and those chakras relate with mind. And so you're redoing. That's why at the beginning of the yoga class, people will come in and there might be a lot of chatter. And then at the end of the class, it's silent. People don't even want to talk, and they're not sure, you know, not because they become so. That's why it's such a beautiful practice. So all the physical postures and including the inversions, they have an effect on the mind, making the mind more introverted, having the mind go in towards away from external physicality, towards a more sanctified place inside. And the process is very scientific, that it changes the glandular secretions.
Mm.
And so, I mean, that it's such a dynamic thing, that, and different personality traits are related with the chakras. And so in yoga, you have this field of biopsychology, of recreating the human personality by exercising the glands, which affect the chakras, which are very much related with mind. And so, so inversions are part of that, forward folds, and all the physical postures have an effect on this transformation of mind, which then naturally changes our entire outlook.
Mm, I love it. Tell us a story about India. I want to hear, do you have a good story? You have a story about one of your journeys there, or living there, or how that's changed you?
India is wonderful. India is a very wonderful land. And the people are extremely welcoming. And it's really a land where they were very much in tune with their own traditions. They really felt like, and it's one of the few countries where really certain aspects of society were born out of the yogic teachings. That they really, there's a word called pranadharma. Pranadharma means what is the natural characteristic of a place, or, and India, anything can happen anywhere to anyone, but different places get developed based on the collective psychology of what's going on there. You know, there's a reason why Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley. It's not because it's in Northern California, but because of the way the people are thinking and living, and it becomes a kind of a collective psychology for ingenuity for that type of research. Mm-hmm. And now there's a place like that in Bangalore, India. But the yogic ideal was very much alive and present. And so if that's the quality that is being embraced by the people it affects, then everybody gets affected by it in a very positive way. Just like if you take those same people and put them in a materialistic society, they'll start to get affected by materialism. And we see that. And India has made that shift, no doubt, also lately. But it has a wonderful legacy and tradition, and it's a wonderful place. And my first time going there was actually by bicycle.
Oh, wow.
We came in from China, and my brother had been to India prior, but I hadn't. And so we bicycled the Silk Road from Xinjiang province, China. Silk Road is called the Karakoram Highway, and it's the highest roadway in the world. You cycle up to 15,000 feet. There's no one on the road. We went a little bit late in the season, and you're moving from a series of high desert plateaus up China to the very top, and then you go straight down into the Indus Valley, into northern Pakistan, the Hunza Nagar Valleys. And then from there, we entered India from the western border on bike, and then we cycled all the way across India. And so I really got to see India from the street level. You know, there was no barrier between us and Indian life. And in India, life happens on the street, not in the houses. And if you travel through trains and planes, you see a small sector of the society. If you travel ground level, walking and cooking and doing all this stuff and living out kind of like we did, right? You see it at a very, from a different level. And it was wonderful. And at that point, I was already involved in yoga and meditation. And so we were going from ashram to ashram, bicycling. And we didn't know where they all were, but we would find one. They'd say, go to this place. And they'd sometimes make a phone call, say, hey, they're coming. They'll be biking today or tomorrow. They'll reach you. And so then we would be received at the next one. And it was a very beautiful trip. And we got to see a very interesting landscape. And it really, not only was it interesting physically, it was extremely, when I came back and I was talking to someone in the yoga community, she said, that wasn't a bike trip. That was a meditative journey for you. You the way you're speaking, because we just got to spend a lot of time with a lot of very helpful people for yogic practices, and in particular one we spent over 1 or 2 months with during that trip. But it was a very interesting time, and it was wonderful to watch the school children walk to school. And in India they all wear uniforms, and they're all beautifully, you know, so you think that people might be living in a house that has that mud is the floor, that has a dirt floor, and that has a thatched roof, and that has no windows and open air, and might have a hand pump as their source of water. But within that, they can live in an immaculate manner, dust-free, you know, beautiful, with such care to everyone in the household. And and that was really eye-opening to witness and to be part of, and to have such respect for people who seemingly had so little materially, but had such rich human connection and social ties, and a very different perspective of what was valuable in life, and very tight familial bonds. So it was very interesting and very inspiring.
Oh my gosh, it is inspiring just to hear you talk about it and the energy of it. And what? I haven't been able to get there in this life yet. Oh, yeah. But my sister has been many times, and her stories are similar in that it's just such a rich, beautiful place. Yeah. Truly, just full of you know, good medicine, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's also the loudest, most obtrusive. It's hard to believe that the country responsible for a lot of the most sublime spiritual teachings also created this external society that is so busy. I mean, the honking of the horns, it can be overwhelming, especially the big cities can be very overwhelming for the senses, extremely. And it's just this outrageous dichotomy. And And but within that is this complete underbelly and nugget of insight, of intuition. And, you know, there, a very well-educated person may not know how to write, and nobody, but they maybe have so much insight because they come from a tradition of storytelling, of oral traditions, of, and, you know, if you did your fingerprint by putting your thumb, that was perfectly acceptable. There was no need to learn how to write for whatever reason. That was, but everybody could talk, everybody could speak, and they would meditate and think. It was a very different way of looking at the world. Their music, their system of music is different, and everything is very, very different. It's quite dramatic. It's very dramatic.
Yeah. I love it. So what's your radical shift? What's next for you? Like what seeds have been planted for you during this crazy wild time we're in right now, and where are you headed with your practice and your work?
Right. A good question. More and more writing, editing, and publishing, and more recalibration of remembering that this life is it's a short journey. It looks like it's a long trip, but it isn't. It's short, and you know we can count, for most of us, we can count with on our 10 fingers the number of decades we're on the planet, and so you to think, okay, what is it that that I to achieve and to really utilize the time in the most meaningful way and most impactful way as possible, and to really refine that usage of time. And I think that that's the main thing. I had already for a long time, I was living in my house almost, I was doing everything at home. I was not going out for any entertainment. Though that had all kind of weaned away for a while. So This idea of staying in the house all the time is quite normal for me. The only reason I was going out was to teach classes, and now I teach classes from my house. So I go out for vegetable shopping and to teach yoga. So I wasn't going out for the movies or vacation. It was a homebound existence, and this further involved in that, but on the same token, you know, we have these great innovations, just like a kitchen knife can be used to make a very wonderful meal, or it can be used in a harmful manner. All these wonderful yogis embrace technology, all sorts of technology. There's no, because their technology is a result of human thought. It's the outcome of human thought. And so we have this technology, we can really make powerful connections with people all over the globe. I've been working one-on-one with someone who had been tutoring and editing some of the yogic teachings that we're working on, who I hadn't been in touch with for a long time, but because of this great medium, and because both of us were kind of anchored in place, we were able to do a lot of work together. It was great.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know what it makes me think of? I probably talk about the Dalai Lama in every single conversation I have. However, if China hadn't invaded Tibet, we would not have His Holiness out going all over the place for the last many decades teaching. Mm-hmm. And this is that exponentially, in that now all of these teachers and healers and spiritual beings, we're all out for everyone everywhere. It's that same idea of it's time for everyone to do it. You know, it's time for everyone to get out there and be accessible and available so that we can create change on the planet. And so I think it's really powerful. I've had more community, and of course, you know, this podcast alone is like, you know, expanded exponentially during this time, but I have felt like I've had more community, even with my own client community that I've had for years, in this time, because suddenly there's no more boundaries holding us back from connecting. It's not like, oh, we have to all drive and go someplace to meet and all of that. It's like, no, let's just get on a call. And it's so easy. Right. And it's become so easeful that you can't say no. And so I've been really grateful for this, because I feel like it's brought, I mean, His Holiness did the Avalokiteshvara empowerments last week live on YouTube. I mean, I don't think that would have happened 10 years ago. And so things are so accessible to us. The resources and the tools are so accessible to us to create change within ourselves, to create change within the communities that we're in and across the planet. It's really incredible how this has happened for us during this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things, like with the yogic ideal, hundreds and thousands of years ago, you had to go to the Himalayas to live with the yogis, and you had to reject the society and do all these things. And that meant the teachings were for, and in India, women were not taught. You know, the women were in the homes, and they couldn't get, there were very few exceptions where they really had access. That's only opened up a little bit more recently. And even family people, oh no, you're a married man. No, this is for the monks, the so forth, so on. And so, but the broader teachings of yoga is like, no, it's for an integrated society, and to live up in the mountaintops and to not participate. We're here to participate in the collective and to help the collective and to help and touch everyone. So that is really, been reintroduced in the late 20th century, that you don't run from the society, you participate in the society, and you make yourself accessible, and you we should transform the yogis call it nuclear revolution. Every iota of our social and human life should be rethought, reintroduced, reimagined, and made as sentient and universal as possible. And so that's very much, so this whole idea of connecting, so although we're secluded in our homes, the technology is a great tool for allowing even more connection than, how many countries, how many people can we physically see eye to eye? We're limited, but the technology is a big boon. And like anything, if there's right mind behind it, then there'll be right use of the tool. And that's great.
Well said, for sure. Can you believe it's been an hour already?
No, I'm ready to do another 23.
Oh my gosh, I know. I'm like, this is so crazy. We're going to have you on again. So I hope you're willing to come back. But absolutely. What else do you want to share with us today before we do run out of time? Like, what else is on your mind? Really enjoyed it. Before you say that, you have such a, your energy is so bright and so inspiring and so passionate. And I just love it so much. So thank you for bringing that and sharing your energy with us.
Well, thank you for creating a space for that. You know, that's a true gift. But I close out a lot of my classes with stories. And if we have time, I have a short story to share here, maybe.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Well, once there was a simple man, and he was walking across a field, and he saw a very ardent advanced practitioner sitting under a tree during meditation. And that man looked at that, he said, I'm also going to do that. That's wonderful. So he also sat under the tree. So they're under two different trees. And then out of the far edge of the forest and coming into their grove of trees, this great mystic or sage comes, and the sage comes up to the very proud practitioner who had been under the tree, who was initially seated there. And the proud practitioner said, oh, great sage, thank you for standing before me. I have one great question. how many lives and how many incarnations must I go through until I achieve the divine, the great goal? And the man was feeling, he was feeling like he had achieved a lot already. And the sage said to him, you will come back on this earth again and again for the same number of leaves that are on the tree that you are sitting beneath. And the man, this very proud practitioner, was sitting under a tree that had so many limbs and so many branches and so many offshoots of branches, but there were very few leaves. Just, you could hardly see a few leaves up there, not that many. But he was so disgusted that the sage told him that even he felt three or four or seven with that he said, he just wiped them away. He said, go. I'm ready now. I am that already. And so, and the simple person had seen this interaction, and he actually didn't have any questions either. But the sage came over to his tree, and he actually didn't have any questions, but he had heard that guy's question, so he said, well, that must be a good question to ask. So he said, I'll ask the same question. And he said, oh, great sage, how many lives and incarnations must I undergo until I reach that magnificent goal? And the sage said, you will come again and again on this earth and go through all the trial of tribulations for each leaf that is on your tree. And the guy looked up, the practicing man looked up, and he was underneath a very small tree, but it had countless spindles, and off each spindle was, and little intersections was like 40 leaves. And there were so many leaves on that tree. They were all over the tree. And it was one of those things, the more you looked, the more leaves you saw. There are thousands and tens of thousands of leaves on this tree. But he looked up with such joy that one day he was going to achieve that great goal in life. And with that thought, one huge wind came and blew all those leaves off. And that is the yogic teaching, that there is no prerequisite other than simplicity, sincerity, wholesomeness, benevolence. We're not in charge of the endpoint. We're in charge of the journey. And we should never feel intimidated. So long as we're true to ourselves, we're doing well. And we will achieve our goal.
Oh, that's so beautiful. That's so, so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Satyam, everybody. He is fabulous and will be on our June summit next week, starting on the 19th, oneheartoneearth.net. And I think you'll be back here again, I hope, very soon. I will get all of his contact information uploaded by the end of the day today here on YouTube. And then it will also be in all the show notes on iTunes and Spotify when the audio is released this week, so that you can get in touch with him and take his classes, right? You have virtual classes, so we can all take your classes.
Absolutely.
I think that sounds like a great idea. I actually need to get on that myself. I'm a very solitary practitioner. I prefer to kind of take my time and do a couple of hours of some good stuff. But every once in a while you get in that place where it's like, I really need some, it's nice to go to the classes too, because you need to have all the different perspectives. So sure. I'll be coming your way soon, I feel.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So you guys, again, Satyam, it's Renaissance Yoga. I will get the website up. Do you want to share your website here for everybody listening?
Oh, sure. www.renyoga. So R-E-N yoga. You don't have to spell out Renaissance. Renyoga.com.
Perfect. And take his classes live virtual. It's the beauty of our new reality and new technology in the age of Aquarius. And thank you again so, so much for being on here and sharing your energy and your insights. And I mean, it's just amazing. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who's watching. Have a wonderful afternoon and evening. We will be back on Friday at 11:11 talking quantum physics with Tim Sanders from Omni. So That will be coming up next. Holy cow. So quantum time. We're going to be talking about the dodecahedron. I always say that wrong. And it'll be great. So thank you, Satyam. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.